that day was more impactful on you than October 7th, because it meant that our lives here were not what we had thought.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall never die.
This is going to be a very special episode with arguably the most special person in the world. She has many titles, accolades, but I know her as Kabon, which is my nickname to her, for her, and her nickname for me. She is my partner, my wife, the mother of my children, the love of my life. So here I am with Yarden Greenspan.
Hi, Kabon.
Hey. And we should say before we start that we never speak English between us.
No.
So this is weird.
I think we'll get through it.
Before I start with the first question that I think you're already anticipating and probably did your homework, I'm going to start a bit differently. Is this weird for you? Did you ever think we both of us would be in this situation?
I mean, I think once you started the podcast, you had mentioned that one day in the distant future, you'd want to have me on. But if you're asking in the bigger picture sort of way, the fact that you would have a podcast about Jewish civil rights, no, I never imagined this.
This is insane.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start in the traditional way. Yarden Greenspan, what kind of a Jew are you?
So since I listen to every episode, every time I listen to your podcast, I ask myself, what would I say? And I have come up with a bunch of different answers, and all of them sort of boil down to, I am an Israeli Jew, which means I am a Jew that never used to make a big deal about being Jewish. It was just something that felt very natural. Never thought that it set me apart in any kind of way, because I grew up in a country that is majority Jewish. It means that I am very naive about what people think about Jews around the world. I mean, I know it, but I, for many years of my life, didn't have to experience it. But it also means there is an underlying resilience that no one can take away.
What is that underlying resilience?
I think it comes from a lot of trauma that we just sort of take in stride as Israelis. I think there is something about growing up in a country where war and suicide bombings and erratic political developments are just something that you are used to and you live with for years. You don't take yourself too seriously. I mean, there is a downside to it. I think there is a lot of unresolved trauma for a lot of people. But I think the beauty of it is that you just know that you're going to wake up the next morning and keep living.
I know the answer for this, but I'm just going to ask because people listening or watching don't. Have you always been this kind of Jew?
I think I was. I think I have always been this kind of Jew. I think I just didn't give it very much thought. I'm a very sensitive person, easily gaslit, easily...
Not by me.
No, God forbid, no.
Not by your husband.
No, it's very easy for me to fall into those pitfalls of wondering if I did something wrong and if I hurt someone and questioning my own morality. And so in that sense, I've always been... I think I had an idea of myself as not being very strong. I think I've learned about myself that I am actually much stronger than I realized.
What happened that you've learned that?
After October 7th, as it happened for many Jews around the world, I suddenly realized that people had a problem with my identity, that the idea of being an Israeli person who is not, doesn't try to hide the fact that they're Israeli, is not apologetic about Israel, even though I don't agree with every single thing the Israeli government does. But Israel as an idea, as a place, as a people, I had to realize, I had to come to terms with the fact that a lot of, for a lot of people, that was unacceptable. And essentially, it was maybe one of the first times in my life that I was faced with this complaint from people in my life, basically saying, the way you are being right now, the way you are presenting yourself is unacceptable to us.
Who are these people?
Former friends, fellow writers, fellow translators, people I went to grad school with. And I had a choice, and I chose to be me. And so I think that was one of those moments when I realized, oh, actually, I can do this. I can make someone unhappy if they choose to be unhappy with who I am, and I can survive it.
If it was a choice and you chose to be yourself, what's the other option that other people might be choosing?
To hide themselves, to be a more palatable version of themselves, to not speak about the things that matter to them, to just be very quiet, which I say this with no judgment. I understand why some people make that choice. For me, it's very, very frightening to not be accepted. For some people, it can actually be very dangerous. Some people are afraid for their physical safety. Some people are afraid of losing their jobs and not being able to sustain themselves. And I think a lot of people don't actually have those existential fears. They just don't want to be isolated. Being isolated sucks. It's a real bummer. I mean, I understand how, whether or not they realize it, for some people, it's easier to say, okay, I'm going to keep my feelings about Israel to myself. I'm going to either be really, really quiet and just not be part of the conversation, or I'm going to be really, really loud as an anti-Zionist Jew, for example, with the hopes that people will accept me then.
Do you think that will work for people?
I think it's a trap. I think the people who believe that, again, I have a lot of empathy for the fear that I believe that they are feeling. I often feel that I can see it in their eyes. I think they just didn't read the history books all the way through, by which I mean that tactic of stripping yourself of Jewish identifiers, of being conditionally Jewish, as Tessa Wexler puts it, it works for a while. There comes a point when it doesn't work anymore. There comes a point when people find you out. You say the wrong thing. You fail to be outraged about something. Or they just realize at the end of the day, you're still a Jew. And if they have a problem with that, that problem is not going away. I can't make someone feel a connection to Israel if they don't have one. A lot of Jews don't feel a connection to Israel, and that's fine. But,
well, it's unfortunate. I don't know if it's fine. It's acceptable.
It's what it is. It's
but
how
it is unfortunate. It's, you know, it's our nation state. Even if you've never been there before, it's the place where you'll always be welcome.
I agree, but I also accept it because there's all sorts of ways to be Jewish. And for some people, Israel doesn't play a big part in it. And I think that's fine. But I think to believe that denouncing Israel will save you or elevate you as a Jew is a trap, and it doesn't work. You know, about a year ago, I had a conversation with Rabbi Ben Spratt of Rodef Shalom Congregation in New York, who is just a deeply kind person and agreed to sit down and chat with me when I was struggling. And he asked me...
Which, by the way, you should note, he agreed to sit down and speak with you and with both of us, even though we were not members of his congregation.
And even though he's an extremely busy man who has a big, lively congregation. I have a lot of respect for him. And when we were chatting, Rabbi Ben asked me, are there places or people with whom you feel that you can be your whole self? And at first I thought that question was kind of funny because I said, yeah, of course. I mean, I have you, I have Shai, I have my friends and my family. And the more I thought about it as time went by, the more I realized there were social situations for me in which I was, without even realizing it, policing myself. Some of it was just me learning and listening to people and correcting, which I think is generally a positive thing to do. And some of it was me just being afraid because I felt like I was constantly putting my foot in my mouth, saying the wrong thing. I even though I shared the same values as these friends, I think sometimes I had more moderation in my views. I had questions. I had doubts. And to bring it back to what you were asking about falling into the trap of anti-Zionism, I think ultimately any relationship in which you are not allowing yourself to be your full self is doomed to fail. And so if people are doing it to protect their social standing, their friendships, it's not going to work. They're going to find out who you are. And if they don't like it, then that's it.
So obviously the past 17 months, as of the recording of today, it's March 11th, have been very, very difficult for many, if not all Jews, and many non-Jews around the world. It's been especially difficult for us, given the public role that I and our family have found ourselves in. I've told many, many times my story of October 7th. But kind of like the in Hamilton, there's that line, the song, the Man in the Room.
I think it's The Room Where It Happened. Us watched Hamilton.
But but it's totally fine. The Room Where It Happened. You were at The Room Where It Happened. What's your experience of October 7th?
So my experience of October 7th was actually October 6th. It started on October 6th. It was Friday night. We had finished Shabbat dinner, I think, with your parents who were in town. Everyone had left. The kids were in bed.
Luckily.
Yes. We were just chilling out. And I think we were about to just go to sleep because it was getting late. And then my sister sent a picture on my family's WhatsApp group. And it was a picture of her son. And I think she just sent it because he looked cute. I don't think she meant to show what was going on, but he was standing close to the television. And on the screen, you could see a list of red alerts for, meaning missile attacks in different parts of the country. That in itself was not a very unusual thing for us to see. There's often missile attacks, but there are usually, it's changed throughout the years and whatever was going on in the country, but often they are all in the south, in the Gaza envelope area. And so that wasn't an unusual thing
to see.
Which
doesn't make it acceptable or right or anything, but that was historically the fact.
Exactly. It's completely unacceptable, and it's also been normalized, which is part of the tragedy. And you, I think you went on Ynet, which is one of the Israeli news websites, to see what was going on. And I don't exactly remember the order of events as they unfolded, at least to us. But you said, oh, there's been an infiltration. Terrorists are in the country. And that was more unusual. And then we turned on the news and we started watching. And the image, I can't talk about it without crying. The image that stands out to me more than anything was a bunch of Hamas terrorists standing with their rifles on a white pickup truck in a roundabout. I think it was in Sderot, in the town of Sderot. And I thought about that image many times since and tried to figure out why was it that? Because after that, we saw such horrific images of dead bodies and people being threatened, people begging for their lives, people crying on the news because they realized that one of their family members had been kidnapped. I think the thing about the men, the Hamas terrorists on the pickup truck, was the fact that they were driving slowly. They weren't fleeing. It wasn't like, oh, you know, terrorists infiltrated and right away the military came and they had to, they shot someone and then they escaped. No, they were driving through the town like kings, like for those few hours or however long it took until they were finally completely gone, the place was theirs. And that was new. That was something that I had never seen before. And it sort of contained everything in it. It contained just how intense this attack was. It contained the fact that the people living in those towns were essentially abandoned and that it took hours for anyone to come and rescue them. And so that stayed with me. We stayed up for a while longer. You stayed up all night, I think, or most of the night. I went to bed at some point. I don't remember when. There was a feeling that something enormous had happened and we don't quite know how big it is yet and what the implications will be. I know that you had a much clearer understanding. I think you said even that night or perhaps the next morning, there's going to be a huge war. It's this. They know what they're doing. Hamas knew what they were doing. They are starting an enormous war. It's going to be terrible. And then the next few days was us constantly clicking refresh on our phones, following the developments. I still remember the relief I felt when we learned that the situation in the dining hall in Kibbutz Be'eri, if I'm not mistaken, had finally been resolved. The police and the military were finally inside. Of course, what they found inside was absolutely terrible. But we were just waiting on each and every part of this attack, and there were so many different fronts to be resolved. And then the days after that was basically us scrambling, trying to figure out what we can do to help. So we spent, I think I ended up spending a few months. The timeline is very fuzzy for me, honestly. That whole period of time feels barely real. But I spent a few months volunteering with an organization that was collecting information from soldiers on the ground about what military equipment they needed.
Protective gear.
Protective gear, yes. Things like ceramic vests, flashlights, underwear sometimes. I mean, just things that they didn't have and they really needed in order to defend. So it was basically months of me getting texts, sometimes in the middle of the night because of the time difference and because these people were on duty saying, hey, we're really short on helmets. We're using really, really old helmets and it's not safe. A soldier that suddenly texted me and said, oh, you know, I know that I said we need this gear, but actually we had an encounter in Gaza and now we're all in the hospital and our needs have changed. We did that for a long time. We helped Nitzan Mintz and Dede Band-Aid and Tal Huber, who are the people behind the Kidnapped Posters campaign. We helped them come up with the wording for the posters, and we helped disseminate the posters when it was still a very new phenomenon.
This is where I'm the proud husband rather than the podcast interviewer. We didn't just help. You wrote the text for the hostage posters that then spread throughout the world. Those were your words.
We wrote it together. I mean, it was a group effort. We worked on it together. And I was grateful that I could play a part in that. And we started advocating for the hostages. And we started joining the marches in Central Park every Sunday, organized by the New York chapter of the hostages and missing people's family forum. Essentially, we just looked for ways to help. All the while, you know, speaking to friends and family in Israel who were really, really frightened and really shocked. A lot of people ask me a lot of times, how's your family doing? And it's kind of hard to explain because they're living their lives. And yet, even though, as I said in the beginning, to be Israeli means you live with the reality of being unsafe, this was different. This was a level of unsafety that I think a lot of people in Israel didn't really seriously envision. And so trying to support them, trying to be there for them and let them talk it out.
You know, a lot of people, well, not the audience of this show, obviously, or unfortunately, I guess, but a lot of people will say, what are you talking about, unsafe? You have your bomb shelters, you know, you get like the 90-second warning. Unsafe is what's happening in Gaza.
Also true. I don't think it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, to be a Gazan right now, I can't even imagine how scary and devastating it is. I just don't think it should be a competition. It's in everyone's best interest, in my opinion, for all people to be able to live in safety. I personally don't see any contradiction between being an Israeli person who cares for Israelis and believes that they have a right to live in peace and safety, and feeling empathy and concern for the people of Gaza and all Palestinian people, and wanting them to be able to live in freedom and safety as well. I think one of the tragedies of the past 17 months, and to be fair, I think this is a tragedy that started long ago, is the way people think they have to choose one or the other. And I realize that it might be easy for someone who sees me or hears me speak or follows me on social media and sees me speaking mainly about the hostages to think that that means I don't care. And honestly, I don't know how to solve that except for reminding people that I do care. I just think this is the sane way to live, to refuse to choose one people over another. That said, I'm Israeli. These people who were murdered and raped and kidnapped, there is no difference between them and me. A few different life choices, and it could have been me living in the Gaza envelope or going to a party at the Nova Festival. I think it's really, really sad when people are demonized for identifying with people who are the same as them. And it doesn't mean you don't also care for your neighbors who share a lot of your DNA.
Do you remember October 12th, 2023?
I remember, I'm not sure at this point how much I remember and how much I've told myself about it, because it was so early on in the war and things were so messy in my brain. Mostly I remember before. I remember hearing that there was a pro-Palestinian protest on campus at Columbia, and that the Jewish students were organizing a rally, a counter rally. And I remember that my first reaction was, why would we do that? Why would I mind there being a pro-Palestinian protest? I'm pro-Palestinian. I believe Palestinians deserve to have a state. I don't think it's us or them. I don't think it should be us or them. And then I read the letter that Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voices for Peace. I forget which other organizations,
just two of them, yeah.
They're just the two of them. The letter they wrote announcing the protest and just generally announcing their view on the situation. And I realized that...
What was expressed in that letter?
I don't remember the exact wording anymore, but it was essentially framing the Hamas attack on October 7th as a successful military project, or something like that, something along those lines. It was condemning the university for referring to the Hamas freedom fighters as terrorists, and it defined Israel as a settler colonial project that is essentially illegal in nature. In other words, it was saying Israelis are the bad guys, Hamas are the freedom fighters. How dare you say otherwise? We are very happy that this attack was successful, and we are going to keep fighting for what this attack was hoping to achieve. And that was a moment when I realized, oh, I am very naive, because I truly thought that to be pro-Palestinian meant what I was feeling, which is we all deserve to live in peace. I personally believe a two-state solution is ultimately the way to do it. I know that people have differing opinions. That's how I always felt about it. Kind of always thought that anyone on the other side came to the same bottom line. I remember you going to support the Jewish students, and I remember feeling nervous because we could already feel in the air that something was going on and that there was a potential for violence. And I remember you coming back different, basically. I mean, I think in a way that day was more impactful on you than October 7th. Because it meant that our lives here were not what we had thought, essentially. I had had this idea when we moved here. We moved here 15 and a half years ago. I'm an American citizen. Both my parents grew up here. I was very excited to spend some time living in the U.S. I didn't think necessarily we'd be here this long. We didn't know. We were coming to study.
We were young.
Yeah. But I had an impression that I was sort of moving to... First of all, I assumed it was a post-anti-Semitic America. I didn't even really think about it. It wasn't on my mind. I was in New York City. There's so many Jewish people in New York City. I felt very comfortable. I remember one of my first jobs in the city was as a nanny and for a Jewish family. And the mother asked me one day if I was experiencing any anti-Semitism. And I thought, well, where did that come from? Why would she even think that? I also thought I found a place where I fit right in. Specifically in the literary / academic scene in New York City, where people held progressive values and believed in justice and equality, and we were amplifying the voices of those who were underrepresented. It just all felt really seamless. And again, I had this thought that, you know, I knew that people had complicated views about Israel. I didn't think those views extended to even the very existence necessarily of Israel. I thought people had complicated views about the Israeli government, about what was happening in the West Bank, and I shared a lot of their criticism. But I think that protest at Columbia, it sort of showed that actually people were very comfortable when something awful happened in Israel, to get behind it and say, good, let's have more of this. This is justice. This is what it means to fight for justice. It means killing a ton of Jews kidnapping the rest.
Raping the women and some men.
Raping the women, killing people in front of each other, all of it. I have not felt as at home in the U.S. since then.
And in addition to all of that, you then have to deal with the fact that I became this thing that neither you nor I planned nor necessarily wanted. What's it like being... And I hate to say this. I hate when people don't understand that you have been 50% in everything, but people treat you as the wife, the woman behind the scenes. It's like, no, the only difference is we can't both be out there. But what has that been like for you?
I actually think that most people give me more credit than I sometimes think that I deserve. I think the people, and it's often the women who come speak to me, for example, at the rally for the hostages on Sundays or
in Central Park.
In Central Park, or if I join you for any event that you do, they assume that I am part of it, either because they know what it is to be married or they know what it is to be a wife specifically. What can I say? I mean, it really vacillates for me. There are some days when I kind of think, whoa, our life has, I mean, it's transformed. That feels like an understatement. And I think about the implications and I wonder what's going to happen to the future of your career. And I wonder, you know, down the line, how we're going to look back and think about this time. But honestly, it's so minuscule. The things people are going through right now, hostages held in tunnels, in chains, starving, soldiers fighting for their lives every single day, the people of Gaza under the boot of Hamas trying to figure out how to survive, and people in the diaspora, Jews in the diaspora who have no community, who have zero Jewish community around them, who don't have anyone to talk to about these things. I feel very fortunate to have the privilege and the safety to do what we're doing. Do I always feel great about it? No. Sometimes I feel sorry for myself, of course. I also, as you know, my mother is an actor in Israel. Gilat and Kori, shout out to mom.
Shout out to my mother-in-law.
Yeah. And so I grew up as having someone in my household who was in the public eye. And, you know, it's a mixed bag. Sometimes it's wonderful because you get opportunities that you wouldn't otherwise get. I mean, through the work you've been doing, I've gotten to meet amazing people. And sometimes it's complicated because you kind of always feel like an appendage. Ultimately, you know, you find ways to deal with it. I try to remind myself that while I'm extremely proud of what you're doing and I play a part in it, we are different people. You are the one who has to be recognized for better or worse. You're the one who has to get hateful emails and hateful tweets and, you know, people assuming that they know things about you that they don't. I am relatively anonymous.
But you are the one that has pushed us twice to contact the NYPD. So I
gotta protect my family.
I get the hate, but you get the anxiety.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's anxiety provoking for sure. I mean, there are some days when I definitely feel like it's a wave crashing over my head. It's not just about you or us or our part in it. It's everything that's going on. It can feel very paralyzing sometimes. and it can stop me from pursuing the things that I want to do, whether they are things that I want to do for myself or for the Jewish people. Sometimes it's all a little bit too much. But I feel like if we weren't doing this, I wouldn't be living comfortably with myself.
So before we get to the things that you have been doing, there's a question that a lot of people want to know. How are our kids going through this? Our son tomorrow is turning 9.
Yeah.
Our daughter is the fiercest 3.5-year-old person I've ever met. I've been away a lot. They are all of a sudden seeing their father in the public eye. They know a little bit what's going on. We take them to the hostage marches.
Well, I think our daughter is too young to really understand. She knows that we go to the park every Sunday, and she says, oh, today we're going to bring them home. And she knows most of the words to Hatikva at this point. But I am quite sure that she has no idea what any of it is about, and I'm fine with that. Our soon-to-be 9-year-old has been pretty amazing. I was very worried about him for a while. I still am worried, but not so much anymore. He and his friends are old enough to not be able to remain naive or fully naive about everything. You know, even his friends who are not Jewish and are not having conversations with their parents about the war, they're walking down the street in New York and they're seeing the hostage posters. Occasionally they might be seeing the posters that are ripped down or markered over. Some of them living in New York City are witnessing protests. They know that something's going on. He was, I think, very upset for a long time in the beginning. I remember that he was having bad dreams. There was one night that he dreamt that he was being kidnapped. And he was just really confused about how any of this could happen. I don't remember when it was, but it wasn't very long before October 7th that we were reading something. There was a mention of killing, of someone being killed. And he just thought it was the most ridiculous thing in the world. He said, people don't kill each other. That's insane. Who would do that, you know?
I remember. I distinctly remember you were reading a book out loud to him. And I was in the room. And we looked at each other.
Yeah.
And we had that moment that a lot of parents have, which is it's not even communicated with words, but it was like,
we're gonna let him stay naive.
How do we deal with this?
Yeah. I felt in that moment that if this is how he felt, if he felt that it was the most preposterous thing in the world for people to kill each other, which is true, then I'm gonna let him stay in that mindset
for as long as we can.
Yeah. And obviously October 7th changed that. And you know, since then, of course, we've been to Israel, and he's had to run to the bomb shelter in the middle of the night. He's had that very Israeli experience of being woken up by a siren and sitting in the bomb shelter and then going back to sleep and waking up in the morning and pretending that it didn't happen. And of course, he's had to deal with you being busier and more distracted and away more than before. Honestly, I think before, he just had it really, really good because he had two parents who were always home in the afternoon and in the evening and didn't go out all that much. It was hard. I think for a long time he was resentful. Sometimes he took it out on you. Sometimes he took it out on me. And I think it also sucks to have to live with two parents who, even when they're around, you can tell that they're not fully there. And that they're worried and they're sad and they constantly have something that they really urgently have to deal with.
And they argue.
And they argue.
I mean,
have we been arguing more since October 7th? Maybe.
I think,
I'm not sure.
I don't know if we've been arguing more, but we have definitely been more on edge.
Yes. We've been more on edge. I can tell you that I feel that I am not always... Sometimes I just... If it's been a really rough day, I'm not fully present, not the way I would want to be. I just want to escape to my phone and look at things that probably only make me feel worse.
What have been some rough days?
Oh my God. I mean, the Iranian attacks, the execution of the 6 hostages in the end of August. There's been many. Those are just 2 examples. There have been many. Even with the hostage releases, which we were so looking forward to, and I'm so grateful for all the people who came home, seeing the way that many of them came home, you know, seeing human skeletons stepping out of the car. When I let them, the kids are a huge source of comfort. They're fun and they're silly and they're so in their own little bubble and it's beautiful. Sometimes I don't really let myself lean into it. Sometimes I kind of choose, or I don't, it's not fully a choice, but I feel that I can't help but stay in my sadness. But I will also say about our son that he has immense pride. And that's something that I don't know if we would have discovered had it not
pride
been.
Pride in what?
Pride in who he is. When we went to his school, I think it was about a year ago now, we went for some parent presentation, and we saw that the kids had all prepared these charts with words that represent them. And he wrote Jewish, he wrote Israel, he wrote Hebrew. When they had picture day at school, and I completely forgot about picture day.
We had no idea there was a picture day. He just showed up with pictures one day.
Yes, but he remembered and chose to wear a t-shirt that had the word human on it in rainbow colors, and he chose to wear the dog tag for the hostages. He's been asking me a lot of questions. He knows more than we had realized. Just a few days ago, he said that he read in a kid's newspaper about the hostage deal, and he had a lot of questions about, you know, what is the agenda for Hamas to be holding hostages, and how is it fair, and how could anyone believe that Israel is the oppressor, and in what world is it normal to just take people from their homes? Unfortunately, a lot of these questions, I just have to say, you're right. It's insane, and I can't explain it, but I've been trying to help him navigate the way people are seeing these issues. For me personally, I think honesty and authenticity are really important. If we ever hope to improve the situation we're in, we have to understand what people are thinking, even the people who don't value us. It's in our best interest to try to understand how they're seeing things.
And that ties into your profession.
Yes.
When we moved to the U.S., I told you we were dating for a little bit, and I told you I want to get a PhD in the U.S., go to graduate school. I told you that I want you to join me, but that I want you to join me with something that you want to do rather than just being my plus one.
You were scared.
I was scared. Yeah. I was a 27-year-old worried of commitment, but also because I believed that truly, like, you should be doing something for yourself rather than... I didn't want you to be my plus one girlfriend / wife. And then you enrolled out of all places in the Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program at Columbia University, where you focus on writing and translating.
Yeah, I did. I studied fiction writing and literary translation.
Why translation?
Well, at that point, I was already working as a translator. I grew up in a bilingual household. Both of my parents were born and raised in the United States. My dad was just a full-on American Jew from Philadelphia.
Which people, by the way, might, if people would listen to the podcast or ever even watch, hear his voice at the end.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Michael Greenspan. That's your dad.
Yeah. I love hearing it every episode. I never skip it. So he grew up in Philadelphia. My mom was born in New York, grew up kind of all over the U.S., but her parents came to the U.S. from Israel, and they had a house in Jerusalem, which they returned to every summer. But essentially, they both ended up making Aliyah in 73. And so English and Hebrew were always very alive in our home. It was a completely mixed language household. I think a lot of the times they didn't even realize that they were switching between languages. And I, from a very young age, was speaking, thinking, writing and reading when I started to write and read in both English and Hebrew. And when I started translating, which was a few years before we moved here, it felt like a very natural way to bring both of those parts of my personality together. And when I came to Columbia and I joined the translation course of SETI, they encouraged us to start thinking more seriously about translating books, which was something I really wanted to do. And it became my career. And I'm extremely grateful for it. I've always just seen it as a wonderful way of humanizing. I think, you know, different places and different people aren't necessarily real to us until we have some experience of them. The only way you're going to actually see people from a different country as full humans is if you meet them in some kind of way. And since not everyone's going to travel everywhere and meet everyone, reading works in translation is a wonderful way to do that. And as the years went by, I started to also see it as a mission. I had the privilege of translating books that dealt with different aspects of everyday Israeli life. Some of it, of course, was related to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Some of it was related to the Holocaust and the way it's memorialized in Israel. And some of it dealt with stuff that people outside of Israel don't really think very much about. Tensions between religious Israelis and secular Israelis, tensions between Ashkenazi Israelis and Mizrahi Israelis, the everyday strife, just the normal things. A few years ago, I was speaking to a translator who works from Hebrew into Italian, and she lived some years in Israel, and she was a very big left-wing activist. And she said, I just don't understand why anyone is writing and translating material that doesn't have to do with a conflict. I think it's the most pressing problem, and we should all be dealing with that all the time. And I said, you know, I understand where you're coming from, and it is unbelievably important to talk about it and to understand it. But at the same time, I think that can't be the only thing. The only way forward is, like I said, to see people as whole people, not just representatives of a war or a conflict. And so to me, translating not only, I mean, yes, I find it extremely important to deal with the conflict, but also to translate books about people falling in love, people losing their jobs, people going on trips, everything. Everything that is part of being human is a mission.
Yeah, we're not defined by the wars we fight and the hate we get, but rather the peace we make and the love we spread.
I think we're defined by all of it. It's all of it exists at the same time.
No, agree with me.
Okay. Okay, yes, Shai.
but at the same time, we would say, and since October 7, you have been shifting your translational work, your focus, a lot of it pro bono and volunteering to something else.
I still do the regular work, and I take every opportunity I can get to translate materials that are either directly connected to what happened on October 7th or to Jewish pride and resilience and vitality and all of that good stuff.
What have been some things you've translated since October 7th?
I translated a report on the violence that was intentionally aimed at families on October 7th.
There was a term for that, right? A new term.
Yeah, this was a report by a commission in Israel led by Dr. Kochav Elkayam Levy, who's been doing incredible work supporting and explaining and advocating for both victims and survivors of October 7th. And the report coined a term for a new crime, which they call kinocide, which is the murder of families. And it explored the way that the murder of a family is not just the murder of several individuals who happen to be related to each other. It was done in a way that intentionally broke apart the feeling of safety and intimacy that a family provides. Both in the way that it was done, the way that family members were murdered in front of each other or had to witness a loved one being kidnapped, and in the way that it destroyed these very small, tight-knit communities where often there were members of the same family living in proximity to each other, and where even the people who were not related felt like a family because it was such a small, intimate community. I've translated the stories of survivors. I've helped edit the book One Day in October, which just tells so many stories, because there are just so many stories of people, some of them lost a loved one, some of them got out, but just the things they've had to face that day. A project I'm about to begin that I'm really, really proud of is Chutzpah Girls.
And they were here. If you haven't heard the episode of the authors of Chutzpah Girls.
Yeah, Julia and Tammy.
You should go back and watch it or listen to it. It's incredible. It's an incredible book, an incredible interview.
And that's material that's not, it has nothing to do with October 7th. Well, some of it does, but it's, again, it's exposing and humanizing Jewish women throughout history who have played small and big parts in our survival and our thriving.
So this is where I use insider knowledge. Mm-hmm. You, just since October 7th, and I'm not talking even about the things you've done before, in Israel, the things that we've done together. But you have helped bring to the world the hostages poster campaign that became a global phenomenon. You have translated stories, testimonies, and research about October 7. You have gone almost every week to Central Park on Sunday at 11 a.m. to march for the hostages. You have protested outside of Colombia and outside of the UN and at Washington Square Park. You are even now wearing a shirt with the image of Emily Damari's hand in defiance, and it says, "Ad ha-chatuf acharon," until the last hostage. And yet I know that you, one, refuse to call yourself an activist, and two, feel like you're not doing enough. What is that?
Part of it is living with you. I mean,
that's not what the audience want to hear.
No, I mean, when you live with someone who is, you're nonstop.
But that's not a fair comparison.
Well, But it's the comparison, the most available comparison to me that I see every single day. Every single day I see you, you know, getting hundreds of messages, working your ass off. It's hard not to compare.
But I just listed all the things that you're doing, which is way, way, way more than the average person. Unfortunately, the average person doesn't do as much, but. Why do you have such a hard time calling yourself an activist? I forgot to mention you're part of the Andrew Hatred Digital Activism.
That's true. We send petitions and sign letters every single day, and we see amazing results, actually, in fighting anywhere and everywhere where Jew hatred happens.
So will you finally call yourself an activist?
I guess I don't fully know what it means. Sure, I'll call myself an activist. I think I struggle with wanting to do more because they deserve more. I mean, I don't think anything is ever enough until we bring people home. So to me, any effort I make is too small. You okay?
I think one of the things people don't realize is the dynamic we have at home, where I take on the logical, rational side, even though you're very logical in many ways, and you take on the empathy side, even though I try to be as empathetic as I can.
Yeah.
And we have these arguments, these fights. Not fights, but like we push each other.
Yeah.
I push you to be more logical, you push me to be more empathetic. It amazes me every time just how deeply you feel.
I didn't plan to cry three times so far. It wasn't part of my plan for today. I mean, I don't know. It's also probably part of my personality. You know, I think a lot of us have that in us, this question of, am I enough? It comes up. And right now, it often comes up in this category of, am I enough? I think I just have a real, like, deep burning love right now for the Jewish people. And it can be frustrating when you feel like you don't know how to show it, or you're showing it, but it just doesn't feel like quite enough.
I kind of want to do a Goodwill Hunting.
No, don't do it.
But I have to. you know you're enough.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing my best. That's how I like to put it. I'm doing my best.
You're enough.
Okay. Let's move on.
The only guest that gets to tell me to move on. Before we conclude, what are your, let's say, top five books that you have translated?
Oh my gosh, that's...
Or the ones that come to mind, because you've translated so many incredible books,
yeah.
Funny books, sad books, thought-provoking books, all by Israeli authors.
And I'm going to forget some, and then I'm going to feel bad.
No, so I'm saying the ones that come to mind.
Okay, so Shimon Adaf wrote a trilogy called The Detective Trilogy.
And explain why, yeah.
He is just... Man, I love him so much. He's just so brilliant. This is a man who has a brain like an encyclopedia. And that encyclopedia contains all of every piece of Jewish scripture ever written.
Including Kabbalah, yeah.
Including Kabbalah, including everything. And simultaneously, the plots to, you know, shows that were very popular on Netflix over the past decade or two.
Every science fiction book.
Yes. He just has a weird and fascinating mind, and his books, this is ostensibly a detective trilogy, but it veers into metafiction, science fiction, speculative, cultural criticism, and it's just it's a wild ride.
What's the name of the three books in the trilogy?
The first one is 1 Mile in 2 Days Before Sunset. The second one is A Detective's Complaint. And the third one is Take Up and Read.
So Shimon Adolf's trilogy.
Yeah. I work a lot with Ishai Sarid, who I translated several of his books already. The most recent one is The Third Temple that came out with Restless Books last fall. And he wrote it 10 years ago, but it's an incredibly prescient prophecy, essentially, of many of the things that ended up happening after October 7th. And it's a warning about what can happen to a country when it is isolated by the world and
taken over by extremists.
Yes.
From its own.
Yes.
It's.
I do a lot of work with Alex Epstein, who is by now a good friend. He writes the tiniest micro stories about what it means to be human, essentially, and to love and to hurt and to grieve.
What's a book collection of book stories that comes to mind?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I work with him all the time. We don't have a book together. But if you Google his name and you go to his website, everything's available, and a lot of it is my translation. Not all of it.
I think one of my favorites is, it's called Imagination.
Yeah.
Stories, Conversations with a 5-year-old.
Yeah, that was a beautiful one. I translated a book called Dog by Ishai Ron, which is going to come out next year with Sonkaro Press. And it's about an IDF veteran who suffers of post-traumatic stress disorder and drug addiction and tries to come back to himself. There's just a lot of great stuff. Yeah.
I'll add a few more just so people can explore what it means to be fully Israeli.
Sure.
And you can fill in the authors. Alexandrian Summer.
Yeah, by Yitzhak Gormezano Goren.
Which talks about the experience of Egyptian Jews and under Nasser and fleeing. My 9 cats, my 7 cats.
7 cats that I have loved.
7 cats that I have loved
by Anat Levin.
Which is basically how shows the humanity through different cats that she has owned and had. And
it's a love story told through cats. It's really beautiful, actually.
Tel Aviv Noir and Jerusalem Noir.
Yes, West Jerusalem Noir.
West Jerusalem Noir.
Yeah. They are anthologies of stories that take place in different neighborhoods in Tel Aviv and in West Jerusalem, and all have a noir vibe about them. There's a story that I wrote that was included in West Jerusalem Noir as well. So I'm sort of a translator slash contributor to that one.
So many more.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
There's a lot. Yeah.
Go look for your Dan Greenspan. Before we end with the Here I Am lightning round, if there's one thing that you could tell people that you have learned about activism for what I've been doing, for what you've been doing, for what you've been seeing in the world, what would it be?
Get up and do something. Don't wait. Don't be afraid. Don't think that someone's going to do it for you. If you see something that bothers you, just do something about it. And it can be the tiniest little thing. It can be a conversation with a friend. It could be attending a protest. It could be posting something on social media. Whatever you can do and is accessible to you, just do it. Don't be embarrassed. There's no other way for it to happen. And no action is too small.
You know that I agree.
Yeah.
All right. So we end every episode with the Here I Am lightning round. Yordan Greenspan, and I know you've been doing your homework and preparing for this, but Yordan Greenspan, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I lift. I lift weights.
What are you up to?
Well, my lower body strength is much higher than my upper body strength, so I could lift a couple of you using the power of my hips and ass.
We're going to have to edit this out.
No, but it's been a really, besides the fact that it's very healthy and it's great exercise, it's been a wonderful way to feel strong in a time when so much makes me feel weak and shaky.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
We don't fit into the American lens. I feel like people keep trying to understand us through the lens of American history. Our story doesn't fit. It's more complicated than that. And we as a people don't fit because we're not just a religion. We're a nation. We're a tribe. And I think that's very confusing to people.
What is your favorite curse?
I find it really delightful when people are surprised or flustered and they say, fuck me.
Fuck me.
I don't necessarily say it that much, but I love it when people do.
When was the last time you cried?
I mean, besides just now, as we were talking, a few days ago when we watched the interview on Uvda, an Israeli TV show, with Eli Sharabi, who was released from Hamas captivity. Not just because he's been through horrifying stuff, but also because his steadfastness in the way he spoke, and you could tell that getting the other hostages out was the only thing he cared to do, and nothing could move him from that.
The embodiment of morality.
Absolutely, and courage. Yeah.
If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Our grandparents. We have two grandmas who are luckily alive and well.
Safta Ora and Safta Lea.
Yeah. I'm a little bit relieved that my grandfather, who was both a PhD student and a professor at Columbia, is not seeing what's happening right now. But I would love to listen more carefully than I was able to as a child to what they've been through and how they see the world.
I want to have you over for another episode just to talk about your four grandparents, including Professor Tzvi Ankori, who was a professor at Columbia. That's another time. What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Chanukah. It's just cozy and warm, and the food is delicious.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I feel like Tu Be'av, which is like the Jewish, sort of the Jewish Valentine's Day, kind of rubs me the wrong way. Something about the story of the boys chasing the girls through the vineyards, I don't know, cringes me a little.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm with you. It's true. I feel a lot safer when you're around. I really do.
Sorry, I haven't been around.
No, you're around. You're good.
When do you feel least safe?
Ooh, when I'm walking around at night alone. Probably the experience that most women have.
What gives you hope?
Young people, and especially young women, and in particular young Jewish women, who refuse to bend and cancel out parts of themselves for society's sake.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Wow. There's a lot, but I think maybe Magen David Adom. I think the work that they do is invaluable.
Magen David Adom. So yeah. The Red Star of David,
yeah.
The Jewish Red Cross, yeah. Basically. The one that cares for everyone rather than some.
Yeah.
Yordan Greenspan, where can people find you?
I'm on Facebook and Instagram as just Yordan Greenspan. One word. YardenneGrenspan. It's a lot of letters.
You're also on X.
I'm also on X as Yardenge. YardenneG. I'm not as active on X.
I just love you so much. Honestly, there's no, I don't know how to end this episode other than tell you how much I love you, how much I'm grateful for you, how much I think every person in the world should know who you are rather than who I am. And I am just so delighted to say, here I am with my wife.
Oh God.
Yarden Greenspan.
I love you too.
I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, here I am.